This is a podcast for Monday, March 4th, 2013, Theories of Knowledge. So today we talk about religious knowledge. We'll be talking more about religious knowledge on Wednesday, and then next week it's going to be moral knowledge and political knowledge. Let's see. The extra credit exam is open. You can review your first and second exam just by submitting a blank attempt, and I'll show you all the correct answers. And then the extra credit exam will be open through Friday of week 10.
That's next week.
Which is Friday of next week. Not this Friday, but the following Friday. And I guess that's it as far as announcements go.
The exam, or the final exam, is going to also be in the computer lab.
Right, yeah, it's during final exam week, starting Monday at 8 o'clock, and you have till Thursday at 5 to take that one. That's final exam week. Oh, that's what I need. I ran back to my office when I was late. I ran back to my office to get these. I got down the four flights of stairs and then realized I didn't have these and had to go back up again. So,
pick yours out of here. I think they're up here.
Because I just got this back from the testing coordinator before class.
Wow.
Okay. So good luck finding yours. Because those include like the online students too. They're just like all in one bundle. If you could keep the, maybe give me like the ones from the first exam separate. So
I don't know. They were both. Yeah.
These are the first ones.
Okay.
These are all cons and stuff. Parallelism. Natural philosophy sounds like the other class. I mean, there's just one.
That's the other class?
I think it's the text.
Any questions on Kierkegaard? Kierkegaard's kind of weird. Kierkegaard is like a Christian postmodern philosopher. He's an existentialist.
Based on Christian.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the first identifiable existentialism was a Christian, because people usually associate existentialism with atheism and Marxism. You think about people like Jean-Paul Sartre, or Albert Camus, or as my philosophy secretary at Syracuse referred to him. I'm trying to order a book by an Albert Camus. So it's Albert Camus, because he's a Frenchman. So you think about like before Sartre, before Camus, before Mary Lou Ponty, and all those French and German existentialists, there was Kierkegaard.
This seems like a pretty moderate existentialist by comparison to Camus and Sartre.
Yeah, maybe so. How would you say he's moderate in comparison? Like, moderate about what?
Camus and Sartre are kind of are more under the disposition that everything is completely absurd. And there's no reason to believe in things like even Christianity, which Kierkegaard kind of follows along with.
Well, Kierkegaard is sort of an odd duck in that what he says is that faith is a response to the absurd. So faced with the absurdity of life, you sort of fall into despair, and at that desperate, quiet hour, you realize your need for God. Whereas Sartre and Camus would say, you reach within yourself and you find something to hold on to. Or you sort of, through an act of will, you pick something that your life is about and pick a direction, or decide that no matter how absurd life seems, you're just going to struggle on. So like, life is absurd. This is a good thing about talking about what this means, the absurd. What does this mean? When the existentialists say life is absurd, what does that mean?
There's no real meaning or point.
No ultimate meaning. No point to life. No meaning. No justice, no peace, right? There's no justice in the world.
Chaos.
You know, there's no cosmic order. Like, sometimes you hear people like, oh, you weren't meant to do that, or human beings weren't meant to do this, or, you know, this is my purpose in life. All this, the sort of idea of purpose, or the idea that you were born to do a certain thing, or that you know, everything's going to come out okay in the end, that life is fair, that if you're a good person, you'll be rewarded. If you're a bad person, you'll face the consequences. That crime doesn't pay. All those are sort of ideas that people believe in. People believe in karma. And Kierkegaard says, you look out there in the world, you see that's all a bunch of nonsense. And you go through your life, and what do? Well, you're going through school, and you're thinking, okay, if I get through school, I'm going to get a good job. And then what am I going to do? Well, maybe I'll get married and crank out a couple of kids. And then what am I going to do? Well, you know, I'll work at some career, and I'll attain some stature in my occupation. I'll develop some skills, talents, abilities. I'll have a nice house in the suburbs. And then what I do? Well, I guess after a while, I'll work and maybe I'll have that first heart attack and have to go back to work part-time. And then maybe, you know, in my golden years, I'll play some golf and hang out with the grandkids. And then I'll get cancer and have a slow, lingering death in the hospital. And that's, you know, and that's it. Like, well, and then what? Well, that's all there is. What does it mean? Nothing. What is there afterwards? Well, it's, you know, the grave. What was there before? Well, you didn't exist before. How does your life fit into the cosmic scheme? Just a drop in the bucket. And the idea is that just on its own terms, life doesn't really mean anything. That your life doesn't really matter. And the existentialists sort of go in different bents. I think that the French existentialist like Sartre would say it sort of acts of courage. And maybe freedom too. And you create your own meaning through acts of courage and freedom. And for Sartre, it's all about sort of political statements and maybe artistic creation. Sartre also talks about like the scientists sort of having the response to the absurd. And Sartre seems to say that it doesn't really matter what you pick. As long as you pick something, kind of throw yourself into it. Have some kind of idea. Ideals. Some sort of principles. For Camus, it's this idea of struggling on. And maybe this idea of will. He has this essay called The Myth of Sisyphus. Anybody remember what the myth of Sisyphus is about? Yeah.
Sisyphus is a king who goes to hell and has a boulder that he has to roll up a hill, and as soon as he's about to reach the top, the boulder rolls down again, right?
Uh-huh. And then he keeps on rolling it back up. And so over and over again, he pushes, great struggle and effort, and just as he's about to reach the top, it rolls back down, and he has to start all over again. And it's this sort of image of futility. The idea of life is futile, that all human wishes are doomed to failure. that no matter what you do, you're going to die, and you're bound to face disappointment and despair, and all the way to the grave, and no achievement of yours will be remembered or last, and eventually it will all be forgotten. And even if you're a famous person, like think about, who here has heard of Mary Pickford? Anybody? Mary Pickford. Absolutely nobody. Right? So you've heard, the name sounds familiar.
Yeah.
She used to be the most famous woman in America. She was an actress in in the teens and just before the silent cinema. She was an actress in the theater. Very famous. I think she was in some of the early silent movies. Model. Beautiful. Talented. And nobody remembers her. And you can think of, like, who do we remember, you know, from history? It's, you know, only the a few people became iconic. And for every iconic person, there are a bunch of, like, obscure people. Like, I was listening to a thing on the radio last night about Mary Shelley. Now, who here has heard of Mary Shelley? Okay, a lot of people. She wrote Frankenstein. But, you know, her father was this really famous anarchist philosopher named William Godwin. And I'm guessing nobody's heard of him. Anyway, you've heard of him. Okay, he's like a really famous guy. He was like one of the first big writers writing about free love, about throwing off government oppression, about remaking society and having society be a group of cooperative, self-governing individuals. But, you know, who do people remember? Well, people like John Stuart Mill, I guess, and Kant. But it's only like the really big people that are remembered, and people who've just done astounding work, you know, they get forgotten by history. But I don't know, why would you care that people remember you after you're dead anyway? That might be another question that existentialists would ask. So, what do you do when you realize that life is empty? That every goal that you have in life is just temporary, ephemeral, and it's sort of like, think about going through life as sort of like, you know, waiting for Christmas as a little kid, right? You're like, how many days is Christmas left? And, oh, I wonder what I got for Christmas. And then, you know, like a few hours after Christmas is over, and you play with your toys the next day, you're like, when's Christmas coming again? You didn't get everything you wanted, and maybe for a week you're happy with all the stuff you get, and then you just start wanting more stuff. And it's this constant wishes, waiting for your wishes to be fulfilled, and when they're finally fulfilled, you're like, all right, I got what I wanted, and then you start wanting something else almost immediately. And so this idea that life is absurd, but futility, it's full of futility, frustration, suffering. And so what do you do when you're faced with the fact that there's no meaning in life? Well, again, Sartre says you sort of pick something to focus your life on, and that gives you a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment. For Camus, it's like struggling on in the face of meaninglessness. But for Kierkegaard, it's this leap of faith. And he says faith is a response to the absurd. So objectively, you look at the world and you say, well, the world sucks, and there's no meaning, and there's no justice, and there's no order. And so you say, well, I can't face such a world, and that's when you cry out for meaning, and then you in your search for meaning, you maybe kind of go along the path where you maybe try different things, and then you think about sort of moral principles, and then finally the highest level of development is this idea where you embrace faith. And that's, for Kierkegaard, sort of the way you face life's meaninglessness is in having faith that there is meaning in the world. So, but there's no proof that's the case. You have to take a leap of faith to believe that there is ultimately going to be justice, that there is a cosmic order, that life isn't futile, that there's more to life than just suffering and death, even though you have absolutely no proof for it. And that's that leap of faith which actually gives your life meaning. Comments or questions? Disputations? Olive.
So with Kierkegaard, you struggle with life's meaninglessness and then find some subjective faith to put your trust in that all of a sudden seems real to you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like a right rundown?
Well, I think you would say you have two choices. You can either say, I won't believe that I'm going to go on like objectively what the world seems like and just become a cynic, become a skeptic, and just be depressed all the time. Like, you know, like a gloomy existentialist, I guess. Kind of think about, oh, well, you know, I get, or try to like wring out every bit of pleasure out of life I can while suppressing my fear of death and decline. Or you can embrace hope and meaning, and that means like specifically some kind of religious commitment, like believing that there's a God and that He has a purpose for your life, and that this life has a sort of, there's a cosmic order and that God's behind it all and that waiting for you after you die. Yeah.
So he was a faith coping mechanism, I guess, or like something, but then like doesn't that like but then so there's no truth in like faith, is that what he's trying to say?
No, actually he says that there is truth to faith, but you can't prove it, otherwise it wouldn't be faith. So he actually claims that to know the truth, I say knowing the truth, to be rightly related to the truth, you have to give up the idea of knowing. But yeah, he wouldn't describe it as a crutch at all. Or he might, I take that back, maybe what he would say is that that we're all born with one leg, and so you actually need a crutch to get through life. This is what faith is for, is to allow you to get along with one leg. And the faith sort of provides the other leg for you to get around on. Yeah.
I've like kind of wondered how people who are really religious kind of relate to that. Like, do you think that most people who are religious say, well, I believe it because I think it's right, but there's no way I never know if that's why it's faith? Because, I mean, isn't that technically the definition of faith, believing something that you can't know?
I think Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know it ain't so. Yeah, I mean, this faith is actually, you know, argument about amongst theologians about what faith really means, what faith means. If you look at Christianity in particular, because this is sort of where the idea of faith is most strong, I think. You know, it's sort of you get a mixture of ideas. In some places, like particularly in the writings of Paul, he seems to say you need to believe things that you can't prove. But in other places, he says, look, here's all the proof. What more proof do you need? So it's sort of like, I think that one understanding of faith is having evidence and then sort of making a commitment even though you don't have 100% proof. So the idea there is, you know, seeing a river and knowing that somewhere there's an ocean. And there, it seems like faith is treated as the, you know, preponderance of evidence or something like that. Whereas a more, you know, Kierkegaardian definition of faith is an irrational leap in the dark. I think a lot of Christians would disagree with that. When you look in the Bible, there's a constant focus on eyewitness testimony, on the fact that Jesus fulfilled various kinds of prophecies, the fact that Jesus does miracles as proof of who he is. He gives signs and wonders. And it's interesting that in the first three Gospels, you get a lot of focus on Jesus as a Messiah, and here's all the evidence for it. And then in the Gospel of John, which is like the, unlike the other three Gospels, you get this picture of Doubting Thomas. And Doubting Thomas says, unless I see that Jesus risen from the dead, unless I touch the place where the nails went into his wrists and put my hand in the side in the place where they stuck that spear into him, I'm not going to believe. And then Jesus appears and says, go ahead and touch me and see that it's me. And then Thomas believes. And then the writer of the book says, Jesus is the one who says, have you seen me and believe? Blessed are those who don't see and yet believe. But then, you know, why are the people who haven't seen believing? And I think the idea is that, well, here's the account. And at the end of the book it says, and this is an account of all the great things Jesus did, and we're passing on to you. These are the things we saw with our own eyes, and we want you to know that this is what happened. So, in the Old Testament especially, you get the obsession with history and geography and the names of people and places. And yeah, there's this idea that this stuff is real. The kind of idea that you should kind of take a leap in the dark and believe something you have no proof for is really something that comes, you know, a lot of it comes out of Kierkegaard. This idea of faith is ultimately irrational. You don't really see that in the New Testament, and certainly not in the Old Testament. So I think you do get in some of the, maybe a few places in the New Testament in the Greek Fathers, like Origen is another guy who has this idea.
I'll just quote Origen. Said, what has Jerusalem? What has Jerusalem to do with Athens?
And you know, we might see this as, what does faith have to do with reason? Or what is faith give Jerusalem, the holy city of Christianity, and Athens, the capital of the Greek Empire and the center of philosophy? And he was kind of bristling against this movement in early Christianity to blend Greek philosophy with Christianity, which is ultimately, you know, what happened. And so you get a lot of and actually, even, you know, while the New Testament was being written, you're seeing ideas from Greek culture and philosophy kind of working their way into the New Testament and blending with the Jewish ideas. And like the idea of an immortal soul, the idea that I think of some of the other the idea of the immortal soul is probably the biggest idea that you get from Greek philosophy that's really hard to find. You can't find it in the Old Testament, and in the New Testament it's sort of the iffy. There's this idea of bodily resurrection, but the idea that you'll be hanging out as a disembodied soul in heaven with the choir of angels, you really can't find that there. Anyhow, Origen, questioning the relationship between faith and reason. And so Kierkegaard thinks that you have faith against reason, that these are two mutually exclusive categories, and they're actually fighting against each other. And it's the person who says, I won't believe until it's proven to me, that is going to miss out. And that to have a truly meaningful life means to give up cynicism, to give up skepticism, and just believe. And then you'll sort of have a kind of a experiential realization of the meaning of life. And your life actually will have meaning. But it's like maybe another statement of the sort of Kierkegaardian type you can find in the New Testament, where Jesus says, unless you come to me as a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. And this is this idea you have to have childlike faith in order to believe in Jesus. So that might be seen. Now, you know, what did Jesus really mean by that? Did he mean put aside your intellectual, objections? Or, did he mean something like, come to me sincere and open-minded, or something like that? So it's sometimes these sayings of Jesus are difficult to interpret and don't have a lot to go on. And people, I think, sometimes also read things into there that might not be in there. So, but people will often point to that. Like the people would say, oh, if you try to use reason when you're talking about religion, you're doing something wrong. I think we point to that passage. But it's not clear that passage supports that point of view. Well, this is actually a good springboard to talking about Hume and his essay of miracles. This is from the treatise on human understanding. The treatise or the inquiry, I can't remember which. I think it's just in the treatise. It probably says in the beginning of the section there, of miracles. Hume wrote two really famous books of philosophy. One is the Treatise on Human Nature. That's the first one. The second one's called The Inquiry. The Inquiry is sort of like a revision of his treatise. And he took some stuff out of the treatise and put other stuff in when he wrote The Inquiry. The treatise kind of flopped, and so he wrote a bunch of books on history, got really famous, and then went back to philosophy. And since he was already famous, he was able to do that too. It's like, what's your name? I think that screenwriter that wrote that story about the single mom in Alaska. What the heck was that called? Just like blanking out of it now. She was like a pole dancer, and she like wrote the screenplay, and it's like, wow, she's really famous now. Nobody saw that movie. To Our House. I'm like that. Maybe I'll remember later.
Well, the woman who wrote Juno was...
Juno, yeah.
Was a stripper, yeah.
Yeah. So this girl who wrote Juno, that wasn't her first screenplay. She had all these other screenplays. Once Juno sold, she was like, hey, how about this one? How about this one? She's like, got all this stuff on the shelf, and she's like, able to sell it for, millions of dollars. And so Hume's in the same position, right? I mean, this is a bad analogy because nobody knows the references. But Hume's in the same position in that he goes back to his flop of a book and says, well, I'm just going to revise this now that I'm famous, and I'm going to be a famous philosopher like I always wanted to be. And then he publishes that. But if you look at the Inquiry of the Treatise, I mean, there is all the same stuff. There's not a lot of difference between the two. So, of miracles. So, what is the doctrine of the real presence? Any theology students here? What the heck is...
No, that phone's brand.
Presence? That's what I read. I get screwed up reading all this old English and British and Scottish philosophy. Sometimes the things are spelled in weird ways, and then screw them up when I try to write in standard American English. Anyway, the real presence.
Maybe somebody would know this word.
Transubstantiation.
Yeah. Not transubstantiationalism, as they say on that Geico commercial. You gotta get it right. It's transubstantiation. Transubstantiation. Also, transubstantiation. So, what does that mean?
Well, when you take the bread and the wine, it's really Christ's body and blood.
Right. So during the communion ritual where you're commemorating the death of Jesus on the cross for your sins, you eat bread and you drink wine. And that bread is said to not just symbolize, but actually be the body of Christ, of Jesus Christ, Savior of mankind, under the appearance of bread. And that wine you're drinking out of the goblet, if you're Catholic, it's a Catholic doctrine. So you're drinking out of the goblet, and that actually, it may look and taste like wine, but it's actually the literal blood of Jesus under the appearance of wine. So that's the doctrine. So the bread and wine of communion, also known as the Lord's Supper, for the communion ritual, are the literal body and blood of Christ.
So you're eating Christ?
Yep.
There's actually a passage in there's a passage in the Gospel of John where Jesus says, unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. And it said that some of his disciples were wondering about him, and he even ceased to become his followers because they thought he was saying, you know, I'm going to die and you're going to be cannibals and you have to eat my body. And Jesus said to his followers, don't you understand what I'm saying? It's like it's symbolic. And in the passage he says, the words I speak to you are spirit and life, which is basically a fancy way of saying, don't take it too literally. This is symbolic. Now, most of the other stuff in the Bible is intended to be taken literally. But, you know, I think Jesus would say, use your head. When I say, you know, I am the door, or I am the road, I am the road that leads to life. And his, you know, disciples don't say, so can we drive on you? Jesus says, I'm the door. Does that mean that Jesus is made of wood? Anyway, the idea of but that the Catholics have, though, is this is, again, like the melding of Greek philosophy and Christianity, because they use this Aristotelian doctrine of form and substance. And so they would say that the form is bread and wine, but that the substance was Christ. This is again from Aristotle. And the Protestants say that's a hoo, except for the Lutherans. The Lutherans have this, they believe in consubstantiation, which is like that the presence of Jesus, that Jesus is spiritually present. So they don't say, they say it's not literally bread and wine, but Jesus is sort of there in some special way. But most other Protestants say that no transubstantiation. So Hume here is quoting a theologian who's making an argument against this. So I think you'll see why he starts out with this in a minute, but this is a good place to start. So he says, there's this guy who writes this article against transubstantiation, Dr. Tillotson. And he says, the argument is a good one. I'm not going to go into the details, but I think it's a good argument. And can anybody tell me what's his argument against transubstantiation? What does he say about it? Why shouldn't we believe in transubstantiation? Well, how do you know about Jesus?
Human account.
Yeah, let's see. Our doctrines come from second-hand accounts. So eyewitness testimony. Okay, so anything in the Bible, like if there's a doctrine of transubstantiation or not, you know, all our beliefs about Jesus and all the things he did, they all come out of the Bible. But it's all secondhand, right? The apostles who were Jesus' disciples, they wrote down accounts of what happened. Actually, it was their disciples that actually put it all together. But leave that aside for a minute. So all the Gospels are each attributed to one of the apostles, one of Jesus' 12 key followers. So you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew and Mark probably traceable back to an authentic apostolic tradition. Luke was he was sort of hobnobbing with the other disciples, and he was a friend of Paul's. John, forget about it. John probably like Johnny come lately gospel with a lot of extra stuff in it that Jesus probably never said. But aside from the historical picture, each of those gospels is supposed to be have been written by one of the 12 disciples. So let's just assume that for the sake of argument. So, but it's all secondhand, right? Jesus walked on water. The apostle writes down, Jesus walked on water. He puts in the Bible, it gets copied and handed down to us. We open it up, it says, Jesus walked on water. Okay, who said that? An apostle. Who was that? He was a guy who was with Jesus for 3 years. Okay, I'll believe that. And then, so that's secondhand testimony. And that's how we know everything about Christianity comes out of the Bible. Now how about... what happens when we're going through the communion ritual? What are we relying on in order to figure out whether we get the body and blood of Christ or just bread and wine? Well, info on transubstantiation. I'm just going to abbreviate. Transubstantiation is... transubstantiation. I'm saying it wrong. Info on transubstantiation comes from, or actually, let me say this one more way, a different way. Evidence of the senses. Actually, I put the word immediate. Sorry for all the revisions. Immediate evidence of the senses shows the bread and wine to be bread and wine. So here he's just saying, look, when you're sitting there, you're kneeling at the altar, the priest puts a piece of bread in your mouth or a little wafer or whatever it is, and you're chewing it, and you're like, this doesn't taste like human flesh. It tastes like bread. It's light and airy and, a little bit salty, and it's kind of dry, and then you wash it down with the wine. It tastes like wine. It doesn't taste like blood. And so the evidence of your senses tells you that it's still bread and wine. It's not Jesus' body. And so... then he says that the weaker evidence must defer to the stronger. So therefore there's no transubstantiation. So you think of which is stronger, the immediate evidence of your senses or something you read in a book based on what somebody else said? Yeah.
I would say evidence of the senses, because when I've gone to church beforehand or in times past and gone up to the altar to do that, they if you're a very young age, they give you fruit juice instead of wine.
Uh-huh.
So it just seems like it's like, oh, it's just got to be this color, you know, and it's whatever, you know. So, clearly interchangeable based on whatever the person handing it to you wants to do, so it lost a significance from when they did that. So I don't see how it can be relatable when it's like bread or crackers or like, I don't know, breadcrumbs, you know, whatever.
Well, the idea is the priest blesses, again, the Catholic thing, the priest blesses it and then all of a sudden it magically transforms into the bread. So, but yeah, I see what you mean. Like, and, you know, Protestants, that they're happy with the grape juice, especially like the Baptists who are down and the Nazarenes who are down on grape juice and so on. But yeah, so you think about which is stronger? Well, it's obviously like the immediate experience you have is more reliable. So you think about like your immediate experience. So you're, I don't know, suppose. Here's a joke. So you have this to illustrate what I mean. So you have a woman, and she comes home and finds her husband in bed with another woman. So the wife carries on and says, "How can you do this to me? You know, all these years together, and you're going to throw it all away for some hussy, right?" And as she's going on into this long tirade, the woman's getting dressed, and she is getting her things together. The man's making up the bed, and pretty soon the man is sitting in a chair reading a newspaper. The woman has gone out the door, nowhere to be seen. The woman's ranty. All of a sudden, she looks around, and the bed is made. There's no woman, and the husband's over there in his easy chair reading the paper. And she says, "Are you listening to me? How dare you?" And he said, "And how dare you bring a woman like that into our house?" And he says, "What woman?" And then she says, "That woman is just here. I saw her with my own eyes." And he says, "Well, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?" Right? So it's the evidence of the senses, like that firsthand experience. If you experience something directly, you actually see it, or taste it, or touch it, or hear it, that's the best evidence there is. Somebody tells you something that they experience, that's one step removed as far as being reliable, and that's not as reliable as something you've seen firsthand. So when you have to have a choice between "I saw it with my own eyes" versus "this other person is telling me that they saw something that contradicts it," I go with what I saw with my own lying eyes, right? I trust my senses. I don't trust more than I trust what somebody else tells me I saw or should be seeing, etc. And so in this argument, he says, look, what you rely on is the fact that when you're sitting there eating the bread, it tastes like bread. You're drinking the wine, it tastes like wine. And so that's stronger than some doctrine by theologians who are interpreting what they read in the Bible, which was written down by the disciples of Jesus who heard him speak those words. And so what's the point of Hume's story here, I guess, is maybe what we should get to. What's a philosophical point about why does he bring up this example of transubstantiation? How is it related to miracles?
Any miracle that doesn't have sufficient evidence?
Yeah, I think that's a general point in the essay, but how's the transubstantiation thing related to that as far as evidence goes? Thoughts on that. You think about like what counts as sufficient evidence, and try to figure out. Well, transubstantiation is sort of an example of a miracle, right? It's something which happens, which is supernatural.
I don't know. It just seems kind of like they're just convincing themselves that it is the blood and body of Christ based on the guy's word, and that's kind of how their whole religion is built. It's just the foundation. It's, oh, I believe that what this guy's telling me, because he's a priest, you know? So the priest has the power to bless. Why not? Why? Because he's a priest. Well, you don't know what he did to become a priest or did not. Maybe he did some unpriest-like things before he was a priest or something like that, so.
You don't know whether he's trustworthy or not,
yeah.
Right?
You just put all your faith in these just kind of positions rather than the actual, actually determining that it's a good person for yourself.
And I think if you look at the argument made here, Hume wants to push this argument forward. This is sort of his idea that first-hand evidence of the senses is always better than eyewitness testimony, which in Hume's mind is always suspect. And it's particularly suspect when you're dealing with someone who's claimed to see a miracle. Yeah.
Does that make him an empiricist in a way?
Yeah, this is Hume sort of pushing his empiricism. And I guess this other guy, this Protestant guy, is somewhat of an empiricist too. So here, again, evidence of the senses, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, empiricism. Hume's pushing his empiricism. And although, you know, the empiricists, you know, use eyewitness testimony, Hume says there's all sorts of problems with eyewitness testimony. And when there's a fight between what you have experienced throughout your life in everyday situations and somebody telling you something that's contrary to what you've experienced every day in your life, you go with what you've experienced every day in your life. Like if I say, every day of my life, I've never seen an object materialize out of thin air. Never seen it happen. And someone says, oh no, you need to go to India and see, you know, this Indian holy man. And he materializes objects out of thin air. He does like antique coins, and like one time I saw him produce an orange. And it's like, he didn't have anything up his sleeve, and presto, and there was the orange. And I was like, wow, you know, this guy's like really spiritual, and you know, what should your response be to that? Yeah, you should say, well, I've never seen an object materialize out of thin air. All I've got is your report. And then what? How, when I hear someone report that, how should I gauge that? How should I gauge that report? When I'm trying to compare, like, I've never seen it before in my life versus this person telling me that they've seen it. How do I weigh those two things?
We take the fact that you've never seen it.
Yeah, I've never seen it. And just because this guy's telling me he saw it doesn't mean that it happened. So Hume thinks that... let's see, I'm running out of room here. Let's see. I've never seen anything like it. You know, versus he tells me he saw it. And these two things are in conflict. Right? There's just not a good conflict there. I should go with this. Talking about eyewitness testimony. So Hume goes through this long thing about transubstantiation to try to illustrate the point that first-hand experience always trumps second-hand reporting. About an event. So this is what I've experienced throughout my whole life always takes precedent over some person telling me something happened which is at variance with all the experiences I've ever had. Yeah.
Or you kind of said this, but it could be like if there was somebody who's a magician and they just are very practiced in making it look like something appeared out of thin air, they could very easily do somebody who's actually above normal intelligence, mm-hmm. per se. So it could just be that somebody's very practiced at making you think something came out of thin air.
Yeah, like if you... have you guys ever seen, like, David Blaine?
David Copperfield.
David Copperfield, too. David Copperfield does these grand spectacles, you know, and I guess they're pretty impressive. But I like David Blaine because he's like, he's doing this street magic stuff where he's just like hanging out on the street corner and he's like, okay, let me see if I can levitate, right? And it's not like, you know, a David Copperfield show where you see him like going way up in the air, he'll make the Statue of Liberty disappear or something like that. He's like, oh, let me see if I can get off. I don't know if I can. He's like, kind of like turns around, stands like this, and then he like goes like this much off the ground, right? He's like, whoa. And then he like kind of falls down. So it's not like it's like a hugely impressive trick, but you're like, how do you do that? And I saw one a special where there were these girls and they're like, oh, he has like some spiritual power. Where I'm like watching this thinking, I don't know how he does it, but it's got to be a trick. So is that a rational attitude for me to have, that it's got to be a trick?
Yeah.
And the question is why?
Because that doesn't seem to fit with the truth of reality. It seems impossible with the way that reality works that you would be able to.
But he is seeing it with his own eyes.
I was seeing it with my own eyes, right? I saw it seen on TV.
Yeah.
But
TV is secondhand testimony.
That's a good point. Yeah. Even if it's live, like I don't know what's going on behind the scenes there.
You can make it hard to see wires.
Right, right. But the people there, I suppose the people there could be plants, but they just seem so stupid. It's hard to think that you get a person to act that dumb. You know, with the things people say. So I think the people who are watching it in person are actually seeing what they're seeing. And you're seeing the same thing they're seeing. And so I'm guessing he has some sort of gizmo. But I don't know how it works. But I know it's a trick. And that's what Yin would say. Why? Because I know that people don't levitate. And I've never experienced it. Why? And it conflicts with all my other beliefs about the way nature works. So that's what's sort of behind Hume's argument against miracles. You see the lights up all the way? I think they are. It seems dark in here. Maybe it's because of the
let's see. I just want to move forward to the light on here. Okay, I can do that one.
So what are some other reasons why so a person could be duped in a trick?
Unreliability of
is an innocent dupe. They were tricked. How about they're trying to trick me?
They're just lying.
Why would someone lie
about something like that?
So you can get something they want.
What would they want from me?
Attention, money.
Drugs.
Power or belief.
Power.
You know, it might be fun.
Their
sex cult. There actually are people. I mean, they have like you have these groups like these. Sort of, they want you to join your cult, which might be like involved in all these things here, right? Joining the cult. A lot of these groups, like the Moonies, they do all these things and they sort of pull the wool over people's eyes with fake miracles and. This Indian holy man, he has a huge following. I can't remember his name offhand. It's been a while since I looked at him. But I actually talked to someone who'd been to India and seen him and really believed that he had these spiritual powers, and gave me a book by this guy that I was supposed to read. And it's just all basically the same old, you know, mystical Hinduism stuff. Plus, it was like Carnival Roadshow. Yeah.
Wasn't it the guy who, like, stared at people and healed them? It came through Eugene, like, last year.
I didn't see him. So, there's all kinds of reasons why somebody's not going to tell you the truth. They might just be, like, a bad observer, too.
Well, yeah, because eyewitness testimony isn't like 100% trustworthy. Because sometimes people just in the moment see something that they want to see rather than what they actually saw.
Uh-huh. So maybe they're biased?
Yeah.
Well, what was this person we're talking about?
Excitable?
Nope.
Mentally ill? On the drugs? Right? Yeah.
Now, what about like those evangelical people you see like talking in tongues and put your hand on my hand, I'm healing you, you know?
Right, right.
Boom, and they like fall down and like, I'm healing. Like, is that kind of crap? Like, the same as this stuff?
I think that gets into like some weird.
Or is that just, like trancing? Like,
yeah.
It would be eyewitness testimony from the people around, not the person that happened to.
Yeah, I mean, you look at like stuff like that happens, like
it's like in your head, though.
Well, apart from that, I mean, the tongue things is sort of it's a thing peculiar to the certain sects of Christianity. But the miracle thing, I like to hone in on that. Like you're watching, like you're flipping through the channels, and you come on that Trinity Broadcast Network or whatever they got up here, the Life, iLife, or I can't remember what the channel. I don't think TBN comes up here. I used to watch that all the time and see these televangelists. They like pop somebody on the forehead and they fall down. There's a great mashup of Benny Hinn, preacher Benny Hinn, and there's a song "Let the Bodies Hit the Floor." I highly recommend it for entertainment value. He like kind of goes like this, and you see all these rows of people. They just go.
In those churches, like, is there like, you know, the applause sign of everybody where it's like, you know, like flashes and like everybody.
Well, people go there. They do seem to get better at least for a while, but when you go and ask, oh, could you have documentation that this person, you know, actually had cancer and now they're free of cancer? Or, you know, a person who's like got some sort of crippling disease.
That's when they say you need to believe.
Yeah. So I think, and usually they'll like, well, we don't have to prove anything. But in cases where they have tried to offer proof, it's sort of thin and hasn't panned out as far as I know. Yeah.
I read this article online one time about a guy that was trying to prove that they were fake, and he had found this old like samurai technique where they somehow harness their kinetic energy into like a half of an inch thrust. So he was trying to say that these people are just getting thrown by this kinetic energy that these people are harnessing, and they just don't know what it is, so they're just like, oh, that wasn't a god, you know? And so it's a little bit of a placebo effect because they don't know what it is, so it must have been the name of God, you know?
By kinetic energy, you're just talking about like normal kinetic energy or some kind of like psychic stuff or some key or something.
Yeah, I didn't read it.
That might be, that might actually be like try to explain one form of mumbo jumbo with another form of mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, that's why I was just like, that was the other thing. It might be one form of mumbo jumbo disproves the other one, but how do you know which one to believe fully, you know?
Yeah.
They both count on each other, but it's a circle, so you've got to pick a side and something else is cool. It's just up to you.
Well, there have been a lot of cases of people faking. Like, there was a guy whose ministry fell apart, and he was, who's this guy? I think it's in the book Flim Flam by James Randi, but there was a televangelist. He actually had, like, an earpiece. And who was it? Not Jim Baker. Jim Baker actually got a raw deal. I read his book, I Was Wrong, which I highly recommend. It's a fascinating autobiography. But he got railroaded for... He basically oversold some hotel rooms at a Christian theme park and got overextended. And then he had a anti-religious, bigoted judge who wanted to make an example of him and all the televangelists by giving him a stiff sentence. So, but it was, this is some other guy. It was like, it wasn't, I can't think of his name now. But he actually had an earpiece. And what would happen was people would come in and they'd like fill out this prayer card and they'd hand it to the guy's wife. And the guy's wife's backstage reading the stuff in his earpiece. And he'd be like, you know, Lula? Is there a Lula here? And then like some woman, a moo-moo, like gets up and starts waving her arms. And he's like, I have, God's telling me you have a problem with the bursitis, you know. And so like basically he's like, you know, hearing this from his wife as a sort of elaborate con, right? So now this doesn't mean that everybody that does this is doing a con. It might be that most of the people that do this actually believe in it, both the practitioner and the person who's being treated, and you know they might be getting some results too, and it may be even that a person who has cancer gets prayed over and then their cancer disappears. But then the question is, if that happens, are you ever justified in believing that God is responsible for that effect? And Hume would say, you're never justified in believing that's the case. And why is that? Yeah?
I don't know. The only thing I can think of is an example I read, I might have been in one of your other classes, where these medical students couldn't figure out why they were spreading diseases, and it was back in the times before they learned to wash their hands after they dealt with the bodies.
Oh, uh-huh.
They didn't realize that they could spread diseases that way. And it was like they started just taking those people and putting them in a different wing with people that had stronger immune systems or something, but they just thought that because these people were in a different location, that was why they weren't spreading as much diseases, but it was really just because they were having less contact with the dead bodies and then the people that were more susceptible to the diseases. So you could just be seeing the effect of, oh, less people are getting sick, it must be this reason, but it's just completely random occurrence that happens every single time in correlation with the real thing.
So maybe something else going on at these prayer ceremonies that actually is affecting the person. And it might, the skeptic might say, well, there's something called spontaneous remission.
So you think about faith healing.
And alternative explanations. So what happens if a person really gets healed? So it might be like a con, like the person didn't really have the disease, but someone's pretending to have the disease, and they have like one of their people up there hobbling around on a couple of crutches, and the guy pops in the forehead, and he throws away the crutches and starts dancing around on stage, and and then the money comes in. So that might be one thing. Or it could be the placebo effect, or sometimes it's known as a psychosomatic. Have to do with the unconscious mind. So if somebody, like in medicine, if somebody in a white lab coat at a hospital gives you a pill and says, take this pill, it'll make you better, and it just contains sugar, it'll make you better. A little bit. And that's because your unconscious mind expects that your conditions will improve, and that actually has an effect on your immune system, on the way your body works, and you'll get better just a little bit. If they give you a depressant, like a downer, and they say, I'm going to give you this pill, and I need you to like stay relaxed because you're going to feel your heart racing. You'll feel a tremendous surge of energy. It'll be difficult to contain yourself. You might have limb twitches and nervous movement. You're probably going to feel like you want to run home and paint the house. But I just want you to try to relax as much as possible. And it's like a downer. The person will start acting hyperactive. Their heart will race, and they'll have all these effects. So that's just the effect of the unconscious mind. And so what might be going on is the same thing that's placebo effect. A person really has the power of belief they're going to get well, and it has some effect on the inflammation that's causing their arthritis or whatever medical condition they have. If they have a medical condition that's caused largely by stress or some sort of mild pain, it might even go away. So, and then what else? Spontaneous remission. Sometimes cancer goes away and we don't know why. Even people that aren't prayed for, it goes away. And why has it happened? Nobody knows. It might be a coincidence, right? What about all the people that got better who weren't prayed for? So, or what about all the people who were prayed for and died anyway, right? So, and then it could be, what else? So these are alternative explanations for faith healing. Were getting treatment. You get actually people who are getting treatment for their ailment and they get better. They would have gotten better anyway. I just remember people when I was growing up, people would be like sick and you pray for the person to get over their cold. And they got over their cold. Well, I think they would have gotten over their cold anyway, right?
It's just like a mental condition that they break through because of the jealous health. Like some sort of writer's block or something. And all of a sudden, because the person's there telling them that it's gone, they're like, oh, it's gone.
And that's probably related to the placebo effect. All
of it. Trusting in someone else's authority might be that part of that placebo effect. But don't you think that possibly another group of humans, that there is some kind of a change in social, I don't know, expectation, I guess? Possibly?
Well, that's still, I guess this is all sort of related to this. Like, people, if you're around, this sort of mass psychology, if you're around people that also believe that you're getting subtle psychological cues from everyone around you, and there's your subconscious mind feels pressure to make that change too, so it sort of piles on. In addition to your personal faith, your personal faith is sort of being stoked by everyone around you, so you get maybe peer pressure.
Subconscious peer pressure.
Peer pressure of the unconscious. It's kind of a weird way to think about it. So all these things can cause you to, can cause changes in your body. And so what Hume says is that there's always going to be an explanation like this. And as long as you have an explanation like this, you're never going to justify it and believe it's a miracle. And he actually gives an argument against miracles. Which I think maybe I'll say that some next time. There's always a naturalistic explanation. Based on ordinary, everyday experience, i.e. the laws of nature. And since the laws of nature have no violations, a miracle can never occur. So he would say that no matter how good the testimony, no matter how much the evidence, no matter how many eyewitnesses say that they saw that thing, you're still not justified in believing it based on eyewitness testimony. Now, what if you experience it yourself? I'm not sure what Hume would say. I think Hume actually might say, well, you felt like a tingling sensation. Maybe you were sitting in one place for too long. Or maybe it was, you know, one of these other things, like everybody around you is acting all crazy and it sort of, you know, rubs off on you. It's mass hysteria. You get caught up on it. You start having hallucinations, that sort of thing. So I think he would say that, that even in some circumstances, maybe you can't even trust your own senses. But definitely when you're going off of what someone else tells you, oh, I experienced this, there's always going to be, and it's a miracle, a supposed violation of the laws of nature. Don't believe it, because there's always going to be some naturalistic explanation which will be better than the eyewitness testimony of your friend who says he's seen something that just doesn't happen. So we'll talk more about religious knowledge and maybe look at some, definitely will look at some objections and criticisms to and of Hume on Wednesday.